she did what a good police officer knows to do. She went to her community for assistance. Lila rallied every like-minded local she could think of to come out and support the book. She was unusually well-positioned to raise such a group. Years of settling noise complaints, cooling down property disputes, letting speeders go with warnings, and generally showing herself to be a conscientious and reasonable representative of the law, had created a lot of goodwill. "Who are all these damn women?" the father who had started it all exclaimed at the outset of the curriculum committee's next gathering. Because, one and all, they were women, and there were far more of them than of him. Margaret was saved. Judy Bloom sent a thank you note. Lila stayed on the curriculum committee, but there had never been another Margaret-sized controversy. The members read new books that were being added to the syllabi and the libraries at high schools and middle schools around the tri-counties, and listened to lectures by local English teachers and librarians. It was more like a book club than a political assembly. Lila enjoyed it. And like most book clubs, though a man or two occasionally showed up, it remained primarily an XX affair. There had been a meeting on the previous Monday night. Afterward, on the way to her car in the high school parking lot, Lila fell into step with an elderly woman named Dorothy Harper, a member of something called the First Thursday Book Club, and one of the townsfolk Lila had originally drafted to help defend Margaret. "You must be so proud of your niece, Sheila," Dorothy remarked, leaning on a cane, a flowered purse large enough to contain a baby looped over her shoulder. "People are saying she might go to a Division I school on a basketball scholarship. Isn't that wonderful for her?" Then Dorothy added, "Of course, I suppose you don't want to get too excited yet. I know she's only a sophomore, but very few girls make headlines at 15. It was on the tip of Lila's tongue to say that Dottie had made a mistake. Clint didn't have a brother, and Lila didn't have a niece. But Dorothy Harper was at the age where names often got mixed up. She wished the old lady a nice day and drove home. Lila was a police officer, though, and paid to be curious. During an idle moment at her desk at the police station the next morning, she thought of Dorothy's comment and typed Sheila Norcross into Firefox. A sports article with the headline, "Coughlin Phenom Leads Tigers to Tourney Finals," was the top result. 15-year-old Sheila Norcross being said phenom. So Dorothy Harper had been right about the name, after all. There were other Norcrosses in the Tri-Counties. Who knew? She certainly hadn't. Down toward the bottom of the article, there was a mention of Sheila's proud mother, who bore a different surname, Parks. Shannon Parks. That creaked a board in Lila's memory. A couple of years earlier, when Jared had gone out for track, Clint had mentioned the name in passing, had said that a friend named Shannon Parks was the person who convinced him to go out for track at the same age. Given the context, Lila had assumed that Shannon Parks was a male saddled with a rather preppy name. She remembered because her husband hardly ever talked about his childhood and teenage years, and the rare occasions when he did made an impression on Lila. He had grown up in foster care. Lila didn't know many details. And hey, who was she kidding? She didn't know any details. What she knew was that it had been difficult. You could feel Clint's temperature spike when the subject arose. If Lila ever brought up a case that involved a child being removed from its parents' custody and put into care, Clint went quiet. He claimed it didn't make him uncomfortable. Just ruminative. Lila, acutely conscious of the necessity of not being a cop in her marriage, let it go. Not that it had been easy, or that she had never felt tempted. Her resources as a police officer could have gained her access to all manner of court records. She resisted, though. If you loved a person, didn't you have to allow them their quiet places? The rooms they didn't want to visit? Also, she believed that Clint would tell her someday, all of it. But Sheila Norcross. In the room he did not want to visit, and where Lila had blithely assumed that he would someday invite her, was a woman, not a man, but a woman, named Shannon, and a photograph of a teenage girl whose smile, sly and curled at the right corner, resembled not just one person that Lila knew well, but two, her husband and her son. 4. The rest was a simple two-part investigation. In part one, Lila broke the law for the first time, not only in her career, but in her entire life. She contacted the principal of Coughlin High School and, sans warrant, requested a copy of Sheila Norcross's records. The Coughlin principal had long been grateful for her help in putting a pin in the brief Margaret hullabaloo, and Lila reassured him that it was actually nothing about Sheila Norcross and had to do rather with an identity theft ring. The principal faxed her the records without hesitation, his trust in Lila such that he was happy to break the law too. According to the records, Sheila Norcross was smart, strong in English, even stronger in math and science. She carried a 3.8 grade average. Her teachers described her as a little arrogant, but appealing, a natural leader. Shannon Parks, her mother, was listed as her sole guardian. Clinton Norcross was listed as her father. She had been born in 2002, making her a little over a year younger than Jared. Until the AAU game on Wednesday night, Lila told herself she wasn't sure. Uncertainty made no sense, of course. The truth was right there on the enrollment papers, and plain as the Norcross nose on the girl's face, but she had to get through the days somehow. She told herself that she had to see the girl, see Sheila Norcross, standout point guard, slightly arrogant but likable 3.8 student, to be sure. Lila pretended that she was undercover, that it was her job to convince Clint that she was still the woman he was married to. "You seem preoccupied," Clint said to her on Tuesday night. "I'm sorry. It's probably because I'm having an affair with someone at work," she said, which was just the sort of thing that Lila would have said if she was still the Lila he was married to. "It's very distracting." "Ah, I understand," Clint said. "It's Linny, isn't it?" And he pulled her close for a kiss, and she even kissed him back. 5. Then the second step of the investigation, the stakeout. Lila found a seat high up in the bleachers of the gymnasium and watched the Tri-County's AAU team go through their warm-ups. Sheila Norcross was immediately identifiable, number 34, darting in to flick a layup off the corner of the backboard, then reversing on her heels, laughing. Lila studied the girl with a detective's eye. Maybe 34 didn't have Clint's jaw, and maybe the way she held herself was different too, but so what? Kids had two parents. In the second row near the home team's bench, several adults were standing, clapping along with the pre-game music. The players' parents. Was the slim one in the cable-knit sweater Shannon? Or was the girl's mother the dyed blonde in the hip newsboy cap? Or some other woman? Lila couldn't tell. How could she? She was the stranger at the party, after all, the uninvited. People talked about how their marriages fell apart, and they said it didn't feel real. Lila thought the game felt real enough, though. The crowd sounds, the gymnasium smells. No, it was her. She was what felt unreal. The horn sounded. It was game time. Sheila Norcross trotted to the huddle and then did something that erased all doubt, all self-denial. It was awful and simple and convincing, so much more conclusive than any physical resemblance or any school record. Lila witnessed it from her place on the bleachers and understood that she and Clint were ruined. 6. As soon as Lila closed her eyes on the approaching animals, she felt the onset of true sleep. Not padding, slithering, or bobbing, but rushing at her like a driverless 16-wheeler. Bright panic sparked her nerves, and she slapped herself, hard. Her eyes flew open. There was no snake, no white tiger, no gabbling peacock. There was no gigantic banyan-esque tree. Where it had loomed in the center of the clearing was an oak. A fine old 80-footer, magnificent in its own way, but normal. A squirrel crouched on one of its lower limbs, chittering at her crossly. "Hallucinating," she said. "This is bad." She buttoned her shoulder mic. "Linny, are you there? Come back."
"Right here, Sheriff."
The voice was tinny, a little broken up, but there was no static.
"What do for you?"
The sound of the power lines, bzzz, was discernible again. Lila hadn't realized it had disappeared. Had it disappeared? Boy, she was messed up. Never mind, Linz. I'll get back to you when I'm in the clear.
You... Right, Lila?
Fine. Talk soon. She took another look over her shoulder. Just an oak. A big one, but still just an oak. She started to turn away, and then another brilliant green bird exploded upward from the tree, heading west into the lowering sun, in the direction the other birds had gone. Lila closed her eyes tight, then fought them open again. No bird. Of course not. She had imagined the whole thing. But the tracks? They led me here. Lila decided she would not let herself care about the tracks, or the tree, or the strange woman, or anything else. What she needed to do right now was get back to town without falling asleep. It might be time to visit one of Dooling's fine pharmacies. And if all else failed, there was the evidence locker. And yet what? She'd had a thought, but exhaustion had melted it away. Or almost. She caught it just before it could go completely. King Canute, that was the thought. King Canute commanding the tide to run backward. Some things just couldn't be done. 7. Lila's son was also awake. He was lying in a muddy ditch on the far side of the road. He was wet, he was in pain, and something was digging into his back. It felt like a beer can. All that was bad enough, but he also had company. Norcross! That was Eric. Eric fucking Blass. Jared kept his eyes closed. If they thought he was unconscious, maybe even dead, they would run away like the chicken shit cowardly assholes they were. Maybe. Norcross! This time his name was followed by a boot prodding him in the side. Eric, let's get out of here. Another country heard from. Kent Daly, sounding whiny and on the edge of panic. I think he's out cold. Or in a coma. Kurt's tone seemed to indicate that this wouldn't be such a tragic outcome. He's not in a coma. He's faking. But Eric sounded nervous himself. He bent down. Jared's eyes were closed, but he could smell Eric's Axe cologne getting stronger. Jesus, did the guy bathe in the stuff? Norcross! Jared lay still. God, if only a cop car would come by, even one driven by his mother, embarrassing as the explanations that followed might be. But the cavalry arrived only in the movies. Norcross, I'm gonna kick you in the balls if you don't open your eyes, and I mean really fucking hard. Jared opened his eyes. Okay, Eric said, smiling. No harm and no foul. Jared, who felt he had been badly fouled, both by the car that had creased him and by these guys, said nothing. It seemed the wisest course. We didn't hurt the skeevy old lady, and you don't look too bad either. No leg bones sticking out through your pants, at least. So we're gonna call it even. After you give me your phone, that is. Jared shook his head. You are such an asshole. Eric spoke with kindly indulgence, as if to a puppy that had just piddled on the rug. Kurt, Kent, hold him. Jesus, Eric, I don't know, Kent said. I do. Hold him. Kurt said. What if he's got, like, internal injuries? He doesn't. Car barely skinned him. Now hold him. Jared tried to squirm away, but Kurt pinned one of his shoulders and Kent pinned the other. He hurt all over. His knee was only the worst of it. And there was really no point in fighting these guys. He felt strangely listless. He supposed that might be shock setting in. Phone. Eric snapped his fingers. Hand it over. This was the guy Mary was going to a concert with. This guy, right here. I lost it in the woods. Jared looked up at him, trying not to cry. Crying would be the worst. Eric sighed, dropped to his knees, and squeezed Jared's pockets. He felt the rectangle of the iPhone in the right front and pulled it out. Why do you have to be such a dick, Norcross? Now he sounded petulant and put upon, like, why are you ruining my day? There's a dick here, but it's not me, Jared said. He blinked hard to keep the tears from falling. You are going to pee in her ear. No, he wasn't. You're disgusting to even think that, Norcross. It was a joke, Kurt said. Guy talk. Kent piped up eagerly, as if they were actually having a reasonable discussion and not sitting on him and holding him down. Yeah, it was just guy talk. We were just playing around, you know, like in the locker room. Don't be ridiculous, Jared. I'm going to let this go, Eric declared. As he spoke, he tapped away at the screen of Jared's phone. Because of Mary. I know that she's your friend, and she's going to be a lot more than my friend, so it's a draw. We all walk away. He finished tapping. There, erase the video from your cloud, then emptied it out. All gone. A gray rock stuck out of the ditch, looking to Jared like a gray tongue going, nah, nah, nah. Eric hammered Jared's iPhone on it half a dozen times, shattering the screen and sending pieces of black plastic flying. He tossed what was left onto Jared's chest. It slid off into the muddy ditch water. Since the video is gone, I didn't have to do that, but Mary aside, I need you to understand that there are consequences for being a sneaky bitch. Eric stood up. Got me? Jared said nothing, but Eric nodded as if he had. Right. Let him go. Kent and Kurt stood and backed away. They looked wary, as if they expected Jared to spring up and start swinging like Rocky Balboa. This is over for us, Eric said. We don't want anything more to do with that moldy old cunt back there, okay? It better be over for you, too. Come on, you guys. They left him there in the ditch. Jared held on until they were gone. Then he put an arm over his eyes and wept. When that part was over, he sat up, slid the remains of his phone in his pocket. Several more pieces fell off as he did so. I am a loser, he thought. That Beck song, it must have been written with me in mind. It was 3-1, but still, I am such a loser. He began to limp home, because home was where you went when you were hurt and beaten. Chapter 10 1 Until 1997, St. Teresa's had been a butt-ugly cinderblock building that looked more like an urban housing project than a hospital. Then, after an outcry had arisen over the leveling of Speck and Lookout Mountains to get at the coal deposits beneath, the Roberson Coal Company had endowed an ambitious expansion. The local paper, run by a liberal Democrat, a phrase synonymous with communist for most of the Republican electorate, called this no better than hush money. Most of the people in the Tri-Counties just appreciated it. Why, customers at Big B's barbershop had been heard to say, it's even got a helicopter landing pad. On most weekday afternoons, the two parking lots, a small one in front of the urgent care wing, a larger one in front of the hospital proper, were half full at most. When Frank Geary turned into Hospital Drive on this afternoon, both were loaded, and the turnaround in front of the main entrance was also jammed. He saw a Prius with its trunk lid crumpled from where it had been struck by the Jeep Cherokee that had pulled in behind it. Broken taillight glass shone on the pavement like drops of blood. Frank didn't hesitate. They were in Elaine's Subaru Outback, and he bounced it over the curb and onto the lawn, which was empty, at least so far, save for the statue of St. Teresa that had graced the lobby of the old hospital, and the flagpole, where the stars and stripes flew above the state flag, with its two miners flanking what looked like a gravestone. Under any other conditions, Elaine would have given him the rough side of her tongue, which could be rough indeed. What are you doing? Are you crazy? This car isn't paid off. Today she said nothing. She was cradling Nana in her arms, rocking her as she had when Nana was a baby, feverish with teething. The gunk covering their daughter's face trailed down to her t-shirt, her favorite, the one she wore when she was feeling a little blue, the one Frank had stretched eons ago that morning, like the strands of some skeevy old prospector's beard. It was hideous. All Frank wanted in the world was to rip it away, but the memory of kinswoman Brightleaf restrained him. When Elaine tried to touch it on their gallop across town, he had snapped, "Don't!" and she had yanked her hand back. Twice he had asked if Nana was breathing. Elaine said she was. She could see that awful white stuff going in and out like a bellows, but that wasn't good enough for Frank. He had to reach out his right hand and put it on Nana's chest and make sure for himself. He brought the Outback to a grass-spraying halt and raced around to the passenger side. He hoisted Nana and they started toward urgent care, Elaine running ahead. Frank felt a momentary pang as he saw the side zipper of her slacks was open, revealing a glimpse of her pink underwear. Elaine, who under ordinary circumstances was so perfectly put together, tucked and plucked, smoothed down, mixed and matched to a fare-thee-well. She stopped so abruptly he almost ran into her. A large crowd was milling in front of the urgent care doors. She uttered a strange, horse-like whinny that was part frustration and part anger. "We'll never get in!" Frank could see the urgent care lobby was already filled to capacity. A mad image flashed through his mind, shoppers racing into Walmart on Black Friday. "Main lobby, L. It's bigger. We can get in there." Elaine wheeled in that direction at once, almost bowling him over. Frank chugged after her, panting a little now. He was in good shape, but Nana seemed to weigh more than the 80 pounds she had registered at her last physical. They couldn't get into the main lobby either. There was no crowd in front of the doors, and Frank had a moment of hope, but the lobby itself was packed. The foyer was as deep as they could penetrate.
"Let us through!"
Elaine yelled, pounding the shoulder of a husky woman in a pink house dress.
"It's our daughter! Our daughter has got a growth!"
The woman in the pink dress seemed to do no more than flex one of those linebacker shoulders, but that was enough to send Elle staggering backward.
"You ain't the only one, sister," she said,
and Frank glimpsed the stroller in front of the husky woman. He couldn't see the face of the child inside and didn't need to. The limply splayed legs and one small, trailing foot, clad in a pink sock with Hello Kitty on it, were enough. Somewhere ahead, beyond the milling people, a man's voice bellowed,
"If you are here because you read internet reports of an antidote or a vaccine, go home. Those reports are false. There is no antidote and no vaccine at this time. Let me repeat, there is no antidote or vaccine at this time."
Cries of dismay greeted this, but no one left. More people were already crowding in behind them, rapidly filling the foyer. Elaine turned, her face sweaty, her eyes wide and frantic and sheened with tears.
"The women's center. We can take her there."
She pushed her way through the scrum, head down, arms out, and flailing at the people in her way. Frank followed with Nana in his arms. One of her feet lightly bumped against a man holding a teenager with long blonde hair and no visible face.
"Watch it, buddy," the man said. "We're all in this together."
"Watch it yourself," Frank snarled and forced his way back into the open air, his mind once more flashing like a computer with a defective circuit.
"My kid, my kid, my kid."
Because right now nothing mattered but Nana. Nothing on God's green earth. He would do what he needed to do to make her better. He would dedicate his life to making her better. If that was crazy, he didn't want to be sane. Elaine was already crossing the lawn. There was a woman sitting with her back against the flagpole now, holding a baby to her breasts and keening. This was a noise Frank was familiar with. It was the sound a dog made with its foot caught and broken in a trap. She held the baby out to Frank as he passed, and he could see white filaments trailing from the back of its covered head.
"Help us," she cried. "Please, mister, help us."
Frank made no reply. His eyes were fixed on Elaine's back. She was heading for one of the buildings on the far side of Hospital Drive. "Women's Center," read the white-on-blue sign in front. "Obstetrics and Gynecology. Doctors Aaron Eisenberg, Jolie Surratt, Georgia Pekins." There were a few people with cocooned family members sitting in front of the doors, but only a few. This was a good idea. Elaine actually had them pretty often when she took time off from her busy schedule of busting his ass. Only why were they sitting? That was odd.
"Hurry," she said. "Hurry up, Frank."
"I'm hurrying as fast as I can," panting hard now.
She was looking past him.
"Some of them saw us. We have to stay ahead."
Frank looked over his shoulder. A ragged scrum was charging across the lawn past the beached Outback. The ones who only had babies or small children were in the lead. Gasping for breath, he staggered up the walk behind Elaine. The call over Nana's face fluttered in the breeze.
"Won't do you no good," said a woman leaning against the side of the building.
She looked and sounded exhausted. Her legs were spread so she could hold her own little girl, one about Nana's age, against her.
What? Elaine asked. What are you talking about?
Frank read the sign posted on the inside of the door. Closed due to Aurora emergency. Stupid chick doctors, he thought as Elaine grabbed the door handle and yanked. Stupid selfish chick doctors. You should be open due to the Aurora emergency.
They probably got kids of their own, said the woman holding the little girl.
There were dark brown circles beneath her eyes.
Can't blame them, I guess.
I blamed them, Frank thought. I blamed the shit out of them. Elaine turned to him.
What do we do now? Where can we go?
Before he could reply, the mob from urgent care arrived. A geezer with a kid slung over his shoulder, grain sack style, a granddaughter, maybe, thrust Elaine roughly away from the door so he could try it himself. What happened next had a kind of speedy inevitability. The man reached beneath his untucked shirt, pulled a pistol from his belt, aimed it at the door, and pulled the trigger. The report was deafening, even in the open air. Glass blew inward.
Who's closed now?
The geezer cried in a high, cracked voice. A fleck of the blasted glass had come back at him, embedding itself in his cheek.
Who's closed now, you shits?
He raised the gun to fire again. People drew back. A man holding a sleeping girl in a corduroy romper tripped over the outstretched legs of the woman leaning against the building. He put out his hands to break his fall, dropping his burden. The sleeping girl fell to the pavement with a thud. As her father went down beside her, one of his hands tore straight through the caul covering the face of the sitting woman's daughter. There was no pause. The child's eyes flew open and she sat up ramrod straight. Her face was a goblin's mask of hate and fury. She dropped her mouth to the man's hand, chomped down on his fingers, and writhed forward, snake-like, from her mother's grasp, so she could dig her thumb into the man's right cheek and her fingers into his left eye. The geezer turned and aimed his gun, a long-barreled revolver that looked like an antique to Frank, at the writhing, snarling child.
No!
The mother cried, attempting to shield her daughter.
No, not my baby!
Frank turned to protect his own daughter and drove one foot backward into the geezer's crotch. The geezer gasped and tottered backward. Frank kicked his gun away. The people who had run over here from urgent care were now fleeing in all directions. Frank had sent the geezer stumbling into the foyer of the women's center, where he overbalanced and sprawled amid the littered glass. His hands and face were bleeding. The man's granddaughter lay face down. What face, Frank thought. Elaine seized Frank's shoulder.
Come on, this is crazy, we need to go.
Frank ignored her. The little girl was still clawing at the man who had inadvertently woken her from her unnatural sleep. She had torn open the flesh under his right eye and the eyeball bulged out, the cornea filling with blood. Frank couldn't help the guy, not with Nana in his arms, but the man didn't need help. He seized the little girl with one hand and hurled her away.
No! Oh, no!
The girl's mother cried and scrambled after her daughter. The man fixed on Frank and spoke in a matter-of-fact voice.
I think that child blinded me in one of my eyes.
This is a nightmare, Frank thought. It must be. Elaine was yanking at him.
We need to go. Frank, we have to.
Frank followed her toward the outback, plodding now. As he passed the woman who had been leaning against the side of the women's center, he saw that the little girl's caul was re-knitting itself over her face with amazing speed. Her eyes had closed, the expression of fury disappeared. A look of untroubled serenity took its place. Then she was gone, buried in white fluff. The child's mother picked her up, cradled her, and began to kiss her bloody fingers. Elaine was almost back to the car, yelling for him to keep up. Frank broke into a shambling run. 2. At the kitchen counter, Jared collapsed onto one of the bar seats and dry swallowed a couple of aspirin from the bottle that his mother left beside the loose change dish. There was a note on the counter from Anton Dubček about the elm trees in the backyard and the name of a tree surgeon he recommended. Jared stared at this piece of paper. What manner of surgery could one perform on a tree? Who taught Anton Dubček, who presented as a near imbecile, how to spell,
and to do so in such nice, clear handwriting. And wasn't he the pool guy? But he knew about trees, too? Would the state and health of the Norcross family yard ever be a matter of any significance again? Was Anton still going to clean pools if all the women in the world were asleep? Well, fuck, why wouldn't he? Guys like to swim, too. Jared ground his dirty fists into his eye sockets and took deep breaths. He needed to get it together, get showered, get changed. He needed to talk to his parents. He needed to talk to Mary. The house phone went off, the sound strange and unfamiliar. It hardly ever rang except in election years. Jared reached for it, and of course he knocked it from the cradle and onto the tile on the other side of the counter. The handset broke apart, the backing popping loose with a plastic snap, and the batteries scattered across the floor. He picked his way across the living room, supporting himself on furniture as he went, and grabbed up the other phone from the occasional table beside the armchair. Hello? Jared? None other. He sat in the leather armchair with a groan of relief. How's it going, Dad? No sooner had he asked it than it struck him what a dumb question that was. Are you okay? I've been calling your cell phone. Why didn't you answer? His father's voice was tight, which wasn't all that surprising. Things probably weren't too super at the prison. It was, after all, a women's prison. Jared had no intention of letting his father worry about him. The ostensible reason for this choice was something anyone ought to be able to understand. In the middle of an unprecedented crisis, his father didn't need anything else on his plate. The true reason, barely submerged, was that he was ashamed. He'd gotten his ass kicked by Eric Blass, his phone had been destroyed, and before limping his way home, he'd lain in the ditch and sobbed. It wasn't something he wanted to talk to his dad about. He didn't want anyone telling him it was all right, because it wasn't, and he didn't want to be asked how he felt about it. How did he feel? Shitty pretty well covered it. I fell down the steps at school. He cleared his throat. I wasn't watching where I was going. Broke my phone in the process. That's why you couldn't get through. I'm sorry. I think it's still under warranty, though. I'll go over to the Verizon place myself and... Are you hurt? I twisted my knee pretty good, actually. That's all? You didn't hurt anything besides your knee? Tell me the truth. Jared wondered if his father knew something. What if someone had seen? It made his stomach hurt to consider. He knew what his father would say if he knew. He'd say he loved him and that he hadn't done anything wrong. He'd say it was the other guys who had done something wrong. And yes, he would want to be sure Jared was in touch with his feelings. Of course that's all. Why would I lie? I'm not accusing you, Jer. I only wanted to be sure. I'm just relieved to finally have you on the phone, hear your voice. Things are bad. You know that, right? Yeah, I heard the news. More than that, he'd seen the news. Old Essie in the lean-to, the gossamer white mask welded to her face. Have you talked to Mary? Not since before lunch. He said he planned to check in with her shortly. Good. His father explained that he wasn't sure when he'd be home, that Lila was on call, and Jared should stay put. If this situation doesn't resolve quickly, it's going to get weird out there. Lock the doors, keep the phone handy. Yeah, sure, Dad, I'll be safe. But do you really need to stay any longer? How to put it was tricky. It seemed somehow in bad taste to point out the simple math. It was akin to saying aloud that a dying person was dying. I mean, all the inmates at the prison are women, so they're just gonna fall asleep, right? There was a little crack at the end of the last word that Jared hoped his father hadn't caught. Another question, and what about Mom, formed in his mouth, but Jared didn't think he could get it out without crying. I'm sorry, Jared, Clint said after a few seconds of deadline. I can't leave yet. I'd like to, but the staff is shorthanded. I'll be home as soon as I can, though, I promise. Then, perhaps sensing the question that Jared had been thinking, he added, And so will your mom. I love you. Be safe and stay put. Call me right away if you need me. Jared sucked up all the anxiety that seemed to be centered at the back of his throat and managed a goodbye. He closed his eyes and took deep breaths. No more crying. He needed to get out of his filthy, torn clothes, take a shower. That would make things at least a little better. Jared levered himself to his feet and limped toward the stairs. A rhythmic thumping echoed from outside, followed by a rickety tin clatter. Through the windowed panel at the top of the front door, he could see across the street. The last occupied house on the street belonged to Mrs. Ransom, a 70-something woman who ran a baking and sweets business out of her home, benefiting from Dooling's lack of zoning laws. It was a neat, pale green house, set off by window boxes alive with merry clusters of spring flowers. Mrs. Ransom was sitting in a plastic lawn chair in the driveway, sipping a Coke. A girl of 10 or 11, a granddaughter, surely, Jared thought he'd seen her over there before, was bouncing a basketball on the pavement, taking shots at the freestanding basketball hoop at the side of the driveway. Brown ponytails swinging out of the gap at the back of a dark baseball cap, the girl dribbled around in a circle, cut one way, then another, evading invisible defenders, and pulled up for a mid-range jumper. Her feet weren't quite set, and the shot went high. The ball hit the top of the backboard and ricocheted up, the crooked spin carrying it away into the next yard, a weed and hay-strewn expanse in front of the first of their development's unoccupied houses. She went to retrieve her ball, crunching across the hay. The ball had rolled up near the porch of the empty house, which was all bare wood, windows with the brand stickers still plastered against the glass. The girl stopped and gazed up at the structure. Jared tried to guess what she might be thinking. That it was sad, the house with no family? Or spooky? Or that it would be fun to play in, to dribble around in the bare halls, shoot pretend layups in the kitchen. Jared really hoped his father or his mother would come home soon. 3. After listening to Reed Dempster's story twice, the second time to sniff out the inconsistencies most inmates could not avoid when they were lying, Janice Coates determined the young woman was telling the stone truth and sent her back to the cell block. Tired as Janice was from last night's argument with her Mexican dinner, she was also oddly elated. Here at last was something she could deal with. She had been waiting a long, long time for a reason to give Don Peters his walking papers, and if a crucial detail of Reed's story proved out, she would finally be able to nail him. She called in Tig Murphy and told him exactly what she wanted, and when the officer didn't immediately jump to, "What's the problem? Grab some rubber gloves. You know where they are." He nodded and slouched off to do her little bit of nasty forensic work. She phoned Clint. "Would you be available in 20 minutes or so, Doc?" "Sure," Clint said. "I was about to go home and check on my son, but I was able to raise him." "Was he taking a nap? Lucky him if he was." "Very funny. What's up?" "What's up is one good thing in this screwed-up, fucked-over day. If all goes well, I'm gonna fire Don Peters' ass. I don't expect him to do anything physical. Bullies usually only get physical when they smell weakness. But I wouldn't mind having a man in the room. Better safe than sorry."
"That's a party I'd love to attend," Clint said.
"Thanks, Doc."
When she told him what Ree had seen Peters do to Jeanette, Clint groaned. "That bastard. Has anyone talked to Jeanette yet? Tell me that no one has."
"No," said Coates. "In a way, that's the beauty of it." She cleared her throat. "Given the god-awful circumstances, we don't need her."
She had no more than ended the call when her phone rang again. This time it was Michaela, and Mickey didn't waste time. For the women of the world on Aurora Day 1, there was no time to waste.
4. During her 22 months at News America, Michaela "Mickey" Morgan had seen plenty of guests grow flustered under the hot studio lights, struggling to answer questions they hadn't prepared for, or trying to justify rash statements they'd made years ago that were preserved on video. There was, for instance, the representative from Oklahoma who had been forced to watch a clip of himself saying, "Most of these unwed mothers have limp leg muscles. That's why they spread so easy." When the moderator of News America's Sunday interview show asked him to comment on the clip, the representative blurted, "That was for I got jeepers in my harp." For the remainder of his term, he had been referred to by his colleagues, once during a roll call vote, as Representative Harp. So
Such prized gotcha moments were common enough, but Michaela never saw an actual freakout until the late afternoon of Aurora Day 1. And it wasn't the guest who freaked. She was at the console in the location van, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed thanks to her tech guy's blow. Relaxing in an air-conditioned roomette at the rear of the van was her next guest, one of the women who'd been tear-gassed in front of the White House. The woman was young and pretty. Michaela thought she'd make a strong impression, partly because she was articulate, mostly because she was still showing the effects of the gas. Michaela had decided to interview her in front of the Peruvian embassy up the street. The building stood in strong sunlight, which would make the young woman's red, raw-looking eyes stand out. In fact, if I position her just right, Michaela thought, she'll look like she's crying bloody tears. The idea was disgusting. It was also how News America did business. Keeping up with Fox News was no job for sissies. They were scheduled to go live at 4:19 after the current in-studio conversation concluded. George Alderson, his pate shining greasily through the strands of his comb-over, was interviewing a clinical psychiatrist named Erasmus DePoto. "Has there ever been an outbreak like this in the history of the world, Dr. DePoto?" George asked. "An interesting question," DePoto said. He wore round rimless glasses and a tweed suit that must have been hotter than hell under the lamps. Pro that he was, though, he didn't appear to be sweating. "Look at that prissy little mouth," her tech said. "If he had to shit out of a hole that small, he'd explode." Michaela laughed heartily. Some of it was the coke, some of it was tiredness, some of it was plain old terror, suppressed by professionalism for the time being, but just waiting to come out. "Let's hope you have an interesting answer," George Alderson said. "I was thinking of the Dancing Plague of 1518, DePoto said. "That was also an event that affected only the ladies." "The ladies," said a voice from behind Michaela. It was the White House protester, who had come over to watch. "The ladies. Jesus, please us." That outbreak began with a woman named Mrs. Trafia, who danced madly in the streets of Strasbourg for 6 days and nights, DePoto said, warming to his subject. Before collapsing, she was joined by many others. This dance mania spread across all of Europe. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, of women danced in cities and towns. Many died of heart attacks, strokes, or exhaustion. He essayed a small, smug smile. It was simple hysteria, and eventually died out. "Are you saying that Aurora is similar? I suspect many of our viewers will find that hard to accept." Michaela was pleased to see that George couldn't keep the disbelief out of his face or his voice. George was mostly blather, but he did have a small, beating newsie's heart somewhere under his Oxford shirt. "Sir, we've got news footage of thousands of women and girls with this fibrous material, these cocoons, covering their faces and bodies. This is affecting millions of females." "I am not making light of the situation by any means," DePoto said. "Absolutely not. But physical symptoms or actual physical changes as a result of mass hysteria are not uncommon. In Flanders, for instance, dozens of women exhibited stigmata, bleeding hands and feet, during the late 18th century. Sexual politics and political correctness aside, I feel we must..." That was when Stephanie Koch, the producer of Afternoon Events, charged onto the set. She was a leathery chain smoker in her 50s who had seen it all and put most of it on television. Michaela would have said Steph was armored against any and all crazy guest opinions, but it seemed her armor had a chink, and Dr. DePoto, with his round spectacles and prissy little mouth, had found it. "What the fuck are you talking about, you penis-equipped gerbil?" she shouted. "I have 2 granddaughters with that shit growing all over them. They're in comas, and you think that's female hysteria?" George Alderson groped out a restraining hand. Stephanie batted it away. She was crying angry tears as she loomed over Dr. Erasmus DePoto, who was cringing back in his chair and staring up at this lunatic Amazon who had appeared from nowhere. "Women all over the world are struggling not to go to sleep because they're afraid they'll never wake up, and you think that's female hysteria?" Michaela, the tech guy, and the woman from the protest were staring at the monitor, fascinated. "Go to commercial," George called, looking over Stephanie Koch's shoulder. "We just need to take a break, folks. Sometimes things get a little tense. That's live television, though, and..." Stephanie whirled, looking at the off-camera control booth. Don't you dare go to commercial! Not until I'm done with this chauvinist piece of shit! She was still wearing her headset. Now she tore it off and began to clobber DePoto with it. When he raised his hands to protect the top of his skull, she slashed at his face. His nose began to bleed. This is female hysteria, Stephanie shouted, whapping him with her headset. Now the little doctor's mouth was bleeding as well. This is what female hysteria really looks like, you rutabaga.
Rutabaga? The protester woman said. She began to laugh. Did she just call him a rutabaga?
A couple of stagehands rushed out to restrain Stephanie Cock. While they struggled and DePoto bled and George Alderson gaped, the studio disappeared and was replaced by an ad for Symbicort.
Baby now, the protester woman said. That was great.
Her gaze shifted.
Say, can I have some of that?
She was eyeballing the small pile of blow sitting on top of the tech guy's laminated day part schedule.
Yeah, he said. It's open bar today.
Michaela watched the protester take some on her fingernail and ingest it.
Whee! She smiled at Michaela. I am officially ready to rock.
Go on back and sit down, Michaela said. I'll call you. But she wouldn't. Combat-hardened Stephanie Cock, utterly losing her shit, had brought a realization to Mickey Coates. She wasn't just looking through a lens at this story. It was her story. And when she finally went to sleep, she didn't want it to be among strangers. Hold the fort, Al, she said.
You bet, the tech guy said. Hey, that was priceless, wasn't it? Live TV at its best.
Priceless, she agreed and went out to the sidewalk. She powered up her cell. If the traffic wasn't too bad, she could be in dueling before midnight.
Mom, it's me. I can't do this anymore. I'm coming home.
5. At 3:10 p.m., 10 minutes past the end of Don Peters' 6:30 a.m. to 3 o'clock p.m. shift, he sat in the booth, watching the Unit 10 monitor, watching the madwoman nod off. She slumped on the bunk with her eyes closed. Lampley had been called off for some reason, and then Murphy, and so now Don had the booth, and that was fine with him. He'd rather sit. Actually, what he'd rather do was go home, like usual, but in the interest of not riling Coatsy up, he'd decided to stick it out for the time being. The crazy cunt was a hot little number. Don wouldn't hesitate to grant her that. Even in scrubs, her legs went for miles. He pressed the button on the mic that piped directly to the cell and was about to tell her to wake up. Only what was the point? They were all going to fall asleep and grow that shit on their faces and bods, apparently. Christ, what a world it would be if that happened. On the plus side, it would be safer on the roads. That was a good one. He'd have to remember that for later. Try it on the boys at the squeaky wheel. Peters let go of the button. Ms. Unit 10 swung her legs up onto the bunk and stretched out. Don, curious, waited to see how it would happen, the webbing weirdness he'd read about on his phone. 6. Once there had been hundreds of rats in the prison and dozens of colonies. Now just 40 remained. As Evie lay with her eyes closed, she spoke with the Alpha, an old female, a long-clawed fighter with thoughts like rusty grinding wheels. Evie imagined the Alpha's face as a lattice of scar tissues, very lean and beautiful.
Why so few of you, my friend?
Poison, this warrior queen told her. They lay poison. It smells like milk, but it kills us.
The rat was in a crease between the cinder blocks that divided Unit 10 from Unit 9.
The poison is supposed to make us seek water, but often we become confused and die without reaching any. It's a miserable death. These walls are filled with our bodies.
No more of you need to suffer that way, said Evie. I can promise that. But I may need you to do certain things for me, and some of them may be dangerous. Is that acceptable to you?
As Evie expected, danger meant nothing to the queen rat.
To gain her position, the queen had fought her king. She had torn off his forelegs, and instead of finishing him, she had sat on her haunches and watched him bleed out. The queen expected, eventually, to die in a similar manner.
"It is acceptable," said the mother rat. "Fear is death."
Evie didn't agree. In her view, death was death, and it was well worth fearing. But she gave it a pass. Though rats were limited, they were sincere. You could work with a rat.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome," said the queen rat. "There is only one question I need to ask you, mother. Do you keep your word?"
"Always," said Evie.
"Then what do you want us to do?"
"Nothing now," said Evie. "But soon. I will call you. For now, you only need to know this. Your family will no longer want to eat the poison."
"True."
Evie stretched and smiled, and gently, with her eyes still closed, kissed the wall.
"True," she said.
7. Evie's head snapped up and her eyes snapped open. She was staring directly at the camera and, seemingly, at Don. In the booth, he jerked in the chair. The pointedness of the look, the way she'd fastened on the camera lens the instant she awoke, unnerved him. What the hell? How had she woken up? Weren't they supposed to get covered in webs if they fell asleep? Had the bitch been deking him? If so, she'd been doing a heck of a job. Face slack, body totally still. Don pushed down the mic. "Inmate, you're staring at my camera. It's rude. You got a rude look on your face. Do we have some kind of problem?"
Ms. Unit 10 shook her head.
"I'm sorry, Officer Peters. Sorry about my face. There's no problem."
"Your apology is accepted," said Don. "Don't do it again." And then, "How did you know it was me?"
But Evie didn't answer the question.
"I think the warden wants to see you," she said.
And right on cue, the intercom buzzed. He was needed in administration.
11. 1. Blanche McIntyre let Don into the warden's office and told him Coates would be along in about 5 minutes. It was a thing Blanche shouldn't have done, and wouldn't have, had she not been distracted by the strange events that seemed to be happening in the prison and in the world at large. His hands were shaking a bit as he helped himself to coffee from the pot in the corner of the office, situated right under the stupid fucking poster of the kitten. Hang in there. Once he had his coffee, he spat into the black liquid that remained in the urn. Coates, the vicious old bitch, smoked and drank coffee all day. He hoped he had a cold coming on, and his spit gave it to her. Christ, why couldn't she die of lung cancer and leave him alone? The timing, added to the unnerving prediction by the freaky female in Unit 10, left Don with no doubt that either Sorley or Dempster had snitched on him. This was not good. He should not have done what he had done. They had been waiting for him to slip, and he had gone right from seeing Coates that morning and done exactly that. No reasonable man, of course, could have blamed him. When you considered the kind of pressure that he was subjected to by Coates, and the amount of whining that he dealt with every single day from the criminals he was supposed to babysit, it was a wonder that he hadn't murdered anyone just from the frustration. Was it so wrong to grab a handful now and then? For Christ's sake, it used to be if you didn't pat a waitress on the ass, she'd be disappointed. If you didn't whistle at a woman on the street, she'd wonder what the hell she'd bothered getting dressed up for. They got dressed up to be messed up. That was just a fact. When did the whole female species get so turned around? You couldn't even compliment a woman in these PC days. And that's what a pat on the ass or a squeeze on the tit was, wasn't it? A kind of compliment? You needed to be pretty stupid not to see that. If Don squeezed a woman's rear, he didn't do it because it was an ugly rear. He did it because it was a quality rear. It was a playful thing, that was all. Did stuff sometimes go a little farther? Okay, now and again. And here Don would take some of the blame. Prison was hard on a woman with healthy sexual feelings. There were more bushes than a jungle and no spearmen. Attractions were inevitable. Needs couldn't be denied. The Sorley girl, for instance. It might be entirely subconscious on her part, but on some level, she had wanted him. She had sent plenty of signals. A swing of the hip in his direction on the way to mess hall, the tip of her tongue sweeping over her lips as she carried an armful of chair legs, a dirty little come-on glance over her shoulder. Sure, the burden rested on Don not to give in to these sorts of invitations, made as they were by felons and degenerates, who would seize any opportunity to set you up and get you in trouble. But he was human. You couldn't blame him for succumbing to his normal masculine urges. Not that a flea-bitten nag like Coates would ever understand. There was no danger of a criminal action, he was certain. The word of a crack whore, or even of two crack whores, would never count for more than his in any court of law. But his job was definitely in jeopardy. The warden had promised to take action after another complaint. Don paced. He wondered darkly if the whole campaign against him might even be Coates's way of expressing a kind of fucked-up jealous love for him. He'd seen that movie with Michael Douglas and Glenn Close. It had scared the living shit out of him. A scorned woman would go to any length to fuck you over, and that was a fact. His consideration briefly flickered to his mother, and how she had confessed to telling Don's ex, Gloria, not to marry him because, "Donnie, I know how you are with girls." The hurt of that went all the way to the bone. For Don Peters loved his mother, had loved her cool hand on his feverish forehead when he was a little boy, and remembered how she used to sing that he was her sunshine, her only sunshine. And how could your own mother turn on you? What did that say about her? Talk about controlling females, there it was in a nutshell. It occurred to him that he ought to call and check on his mother, but then he thought, forget it, she was a big girl. The current situation stank of female conspiracy, seduction and entrapment. That the loony in Unit 10 had somehow known the warden would be calling him in pretty much sealed the deal. He wouldn't say they were all in it together, no, he wouldn't go that far, it would be crazy, but he wouldn't say they weren't, either. He sat on the edge of the warden's desk and accidentally jarred a small leather bag off the edge onto the floor. Don bent to pick the bag up. It looked like what you might use to put your toothbrush in if you were traveling, but it was nice leather. He unzipped it. Inside the bag was a bottle of dark red nail polish, like that was going to distract anyone from noticing that Coates was a hideous witch. A pair of tweezers, a pair of nail clippers, a small comb, a few unopened tabs of Prilosec, and a prescription pill bottle. Don read the label. Janice Coates, Xanax, 10 milligrams. 2.
Jeanette, you believe this?
It was Angel Fitzroy, and the question made Jeanette clench up inside. Was what true? That Peters had taken her into the corner by the Coke machine and made her beat him off? Her headache wasn't just a headache anymore. It was a series of explosions. Bang, bang, bang. But no, that wasn't what Angel was talking about. Couldn't be. Ree would never tell anyone, Jeanette tried to comfort herself, her thoughts like shouts inside her skull, yet barely discernible over the detonation set off by her migraine. Then she guessed, hoped, what Angel was talking about.
You mean the sleep thing?
Angel stood in the doorframe of the cell. Jeanette was on her bunk, Ree was off somewhere. The floor of the wing was open in the late afternoon, everyone on good report, free to roam.
Yeah, of course that's what I mean.
Angel slid smoothly into the cell, pulled up the single chair.
You can't sleep. None of us can. Won't be too much of a problem for me, because I don't sleep much anyway. Never did, not even as a kid. Sleeping's like being dead.
The news of Aurora had struck Jeanette as preposterous. Women cocooned in their sleep? Had the migraine ruined her mind somehow? She wanted to take a shower, but she didn't want to talk to a guard. They wouldn't let her anyway. A prison had rules. The guards, oh, excuse me, the officers, were the rules incarnate. You had to do what they said, or bingo, bad report. My head really hurts, Angel. I have a migraine. I can't handle the crazy. Angel inhaled deeply and loudly through her long, bony nose.
Listen, sis.
I'm not your sister, Angel. Jeanette was in too much pain to worry about how Angel would take a rebuke.
But Angel just rolled right along.
This thing's crazy, but it's real. I just seen Nell and Celia, what's left of them anyway. They went to sleep, and now they wrapped up like fucking Christmas presents. Someone said McDavid's got it, too.